The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Are you interested in the cutting edge of investing? That means frontier and emerging markets. And would you like to get started? Or perhaps you are already investing but still have questions. Welcome to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. On today's program, we'll take a look at news, trends, and background information that you should know to become an informed investor in new and emerging opportunities. Now, here is your host, Gavin Graham.
Hello, I'm Gavin Graham, and this is Emerging and Frontier Market Investing. I'm here on Voice America with you each Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Eastern, 6 a.m. Pacific, and 2 p.m. in the UK. With the global roster of experts that we have on the show, I look at the issues and the countries which you need to know about if you're interested in emerging and frontier markets investing. We'll look at what works in these markets right now and what we believe will work in the future. I spent most of my professional life analyzing investments and hiring fund managers to handle large amounts of investors' money, and I figure that I can spot the difference between promising investments and those which may be a little less promising. By emerging markets, of course, we mean the BRIC countries, that's Brazil, Russia, India, and China, but that also includes a number of other large emerging markets such as Turkey, Chile, Mexico, and the Czech Republic. Today, we'll be talking to a fund manager about Brazil, which has been one of the worst performing markets so far this year, but reasons for optimism. By frontier markets, we mean the next generation of emerging markets, markets like Colombia, Vietnam, Nigeria, Kenya, Bangladesh, Kazakhstan, Ghana, Slovakia, and Botswana. I'll be talking to another fund manager about his outlook for several African nations after his visit there. And with an African theme this week, we'll be talking to someone in Ghana. We'll also have a report from a Thomson Reuters journalist about the flow of initial public offerings that's taking place in Dubai. And they may find their way into some of the frontier markets funds. That's an interesting to see that the Dubai market is now recovering from its financial crisis in 2008-09. As the situation in Washington rumbles on, I'll be asking my guests whether frontier markets have suffered any impact from the government impasse, and I think you'll like their answers. Most of the people who we have spoken to feel that it's not really having much effect, although we do have the debt ceiling deadline of October 17th looming in 10 days or so. Before speaking to our first guest, though, I'd like to briefly touch on some comments which appeared in Barron's in September the 30th. In his column entitled ETF Focus, Brennan Conway outlined some of the risks of frontier markets investing and generally dissuaded investors from becoming involved in frontier markets, saying that if you want something risky, you should be in emerging markets. You don't need to be risky and exotic. However, his research focused on frontier exchange-traded funds, which are by definition are passively managed funds built around an index. Various editions of this program in our recent book, Investing in Frontier Markets, we acknowledge that frontier markets ETFs are not the best way to get exposure, and we believe that an actively managed global frontier fund is the best way to go. And I'm delighted to have the manager of one of the most successful of those funds on the line now. My first guest is Thomas Vester, on the line from London, the London offices of Lloyd George Management. He's a director at Lloyd George. Before that, he was at Bank Invest in Copenhagen, where he specialized first in Latin America and Eastern Europe and became manager of its Eastern European fund and then launched one of the first frontier markets funds. Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Market Investing, Thomas.
Thank you, Gavin, and thank you for inviting me back.
Not at all. Now, you've just returned from a research trip to Africa, which included the southern African countries of Namibia, Malawi, Mozambique, and Ghana. Before we drill down into what you saw on your trip, is it fair to say that really none of these frontier markets have been much affected by the impasse on the budget in the US?
Yeah, that's a very fair comment. They are not at all seeing the effects yet. the ones that will see the effect will be the resource economies if the U.S. will not manage to raise the debt ceiling and will have a at least a technical default. That they will see some impact, but we will have and wait and see another 3 weeks, as you pointed out.
Okay. So as a result of your trip, many people have said that Africa has the potential to be the next China. Would you say that's fair, or is it something of an exaggeration?
That is definitely an exaggeration because, I mean, China had a phenomenal capacity to develop infrastructure and get invest in its export sector and get that rolling. And Africa does not have the same central planning in general in most governments, or in fact, I would say all governments. So they don't have that capacity, but that doesn't mean that the opportunity is not there, because Africa is simply coming from such a low economic base, as we just discussed before, Gavin. So the opportunity is tremendous. You shouldn't just not expect it to be a replicate of what China has been through the last 20 years.
No, I think that's fair. But at the same time, the comments generally, I think, have tended to be about the potential, taking into account the lack of infrastructure or the ability to spend money on infrastructure in the same way as China's done. Of the countries that you visited, specifically the Southern Africa ones of Namibia, Malawi, and Mozambique, they have several common features, I think you suggested, which make them attractive as an investment destination.
I mean, first of all, what we realize from traveling, and as you know, Gavin, I mean, you pointed out in the beginning with the passive investments. I mean, when you do active asset management, you want to go there, you want to kick the tires, you want to meet the management to feel comfortable that the companies you're investing in on the behalf of your investors are really truly good companies. And what really is striking us during our travels continuously is the quality of the management, the quality of the companies you can find on the ground. And that's really one of the factors that are really going through. Another factor we're seeing is the potential that is going through for agriculture. More than 50% of the global stock of uncultivated arable land is on the continent of Africa, and that is a huge potential for Africa with this global population that is growing significantly over the next 50 years, and Africa can be the biggest benefiter from that indeed.
So you've got the quality of company management, which is obviously a specific company thing. The agricultural potential is large, but still there. But have there been improvements in the quality of government in Southern Africa in terms of the way that these countries are approaching things like changes of power, reduced conflict, and things like that?
I mean, there has been indeed. I mean, as you always talk about, Gavin, you can't generalize, but we have seen more and more democratic transitions, and that is the absolute key for the continent of Africa. So we saw Kenyatta getting democratic elected in Kenya this year. I met President Kufuor in Ghana, who stepped down democratically and handed over. I met him last week. We have seen President Banda stepping down last year democratically in Zambia. We have seen a democratic shift in Mozambique that I went to. I met on my travel to Malawi. I had the honor of meeting President Joyce Banda for the second time, and she made it very clear in the upcoming election. I mean, obviously, she's hoping to win, but she made it very clear that she will respect the choice of the people, and that is absolutely crucial that we have more and more freely and democratic elected governments, and there are democratic transitions. And I mean, Zimbabwe recently had their elections, and they have been broadly recognized as freely and fairly, especially by the African community. And it's important that we are not from the West coming and dictating what it is, democracy is. It's very important that we also leave African nation and the African intercommunity to decide themselves what is democracy, how they want to handle it. But the trend is definitely positive, and that is a huge positive for long-term investors on the continent of Africa.
So Thomas, encouraging news there, and you know, across a number of countries. As far as the specific opportunities for sort of what, which sector would you pick in, or sectors would you pick in the Southern African trio? So for Malawi, Namibia, and Mozambique, if you were saying one thing about them that looks interesting from an investment point of view, which would be the sectors?
I mean, Gavin, I always come back to the things you need when an economy develops. What do you need? I mean, first of all, you will start buying some food products above your basic needs just to get full in your stomach. You will start maybe buying a Coke once in a while. You will start to buy some crisps, some cookies. So that's a good starting point. Eventually, you will get a mobile phone, like we've seen. More than half of the population on the continent now is getting. But that means that the other half still doesn't have mobile phone. You will start to use data service, so telecom is a good idea. And then you will get a bank account down the way, and so the banks is a huge opportunity. And eventually, you will start insuring your car and your life. So why not have the focus on that sector as well? And that's really what we keep the focus on.
Right, Mature. And as you say, that's a fairly common transition for all developing countries. I mean, the resource side, particularly things like diamonds for Namibia or the sort of oil and gas we're seeing in Mozambique, those are presumably great opportunities, but more in the sense of rising income so people can afford the mobile phones and the food and beverage and the like, rather than being able to play those directly, correct?
Exactly. I mean, one of the things that encouraged me the most during my travels, when I went to Mozambique, on to Malawi, on to Namibia, is the diversity. So you go to Mozambique, it's driven by the gas exploration and the coal exploration in the Tet province of Mozambique. Then you come to Malawi, that is driven by the tobacco production that is coming back after Joyce Banda took power. And then you're going to Namibia, and that is really driven by the diamonds and the uranium. But it's a very significant diversity, and that is really encouraging from an investment point of view. So if you put together a portfolio, you can really diversify that away. But Gavin, you're absolutely right in your comment. Investors should never make the mistake and just assume that the things that drive the economy is always also the best place to put your money in directly when you invest.
No, I think that's fair enough. And just to finish up, Thomas, again, we've discussed this several times before, but to reiterate for those who may be hearing for the first time or just for the importance of this point, the timescale that you're looking at as far as frontier markets are concerned would be a long-term one, correct?
I mean, indeed, when you not even haven't penetrated mobile phones yet and most people don't have a bank account. I mean, as a reference, Gavin, I when I met with a microfinance company in Namibia, they are charging 100% interest rate. It's just not per annum, it's per month. So, I mean, this is just only starting for Africa, what we've seen in more developed emerging markets. So take your slice of your pension fund or your kids' college fund with a 10-year-plus horizon and put it aside and leave it and let it do its work. So and then you should probably do well over the long term.
Excellent. Thanks very much indeed, Thomas. Always good to talk to you and to get the insights from your travels. And I'm sure we'll be touching on this again when we speak.
Thank you very much, Gavin. Bye.
Cheers. Bye. Our thanks to Thomas Vester at Lloyd George Management in London. When I come back from the break, we'll be talking about Brazil with a fund manager with some interesting stock picks for those people looking at this market.
Think you've seen everything there is to see in online television? Let us surprise you. Visit voiceamerica.tv today for sports, health, business, and more on demand 24/7.
This program is produced by EFMI Media, which has become the leader in information about emerging and frontier markets investing. EFMI recently compiled the book entitled Investing in Frontier Markets: Opportunity, Risk, and Role in an Investment Portfolio, set for release by John Wiley & Sons later this year, and another book, also on frontier markets, which will be on store bookshelves later in the year. We are also launching a newsletter called EFMI. For more information, email info@emergingfrontier.ca. For more news about upcoming program segments, the books we have written, or the EFMI newsletter, please email info@emergingfrontier.ca. You can call 416-944-1750.
Are you feeling slammed and suckered in today's stock market? If so, then you need to tune in to Profitable Investing with Jordan Kimmel. Every Thursday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, Jordan Kimmel will train you in what you can do to beat up the big boys on Wall Street, as well as share his secrets to success so that you can buy and sell like a profit-pumping pro. Grab the bull market by the horns and listen to Profitable Investing with Jordan Kimmel every Thursday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, right here on the Bottom Line in Business Talk, Voice America Business.
Is your business model robust enough? In today's ever-changing business environment, people are working to transform themselves, their futures, and their business. Tune in to Business Reinvention with your host, Nancy Lynn. To stay ahead of the game in business, you have to constantly reinvent yourself and your organization. With Nancy's experience and that of her guest experts, you'll learn from stories of inspiration, innovation, and forward thinking. Listen for Business Reinvention, live every Monday at 4 p.m. Pacific Time, 7 p.m. Eastern Time, on the Voice America Business Channel.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Market Investing. I'm Gavin Graham. Now, we've talked several times about the expression, the BRIC countries, that's Brazil, Russia, India, and China, which is over a decade old, hard to believe, and whether or not it's actually becoming obsolete. The reasons usually mentioned for this include the suggestion that the four economies have developed very differently over the past decade, so to use a sort of portmanteau term, which includes all of them, is actually not particularly useful anymore. India has its share of problems with high inflation. Russia is very largely a resource-based play with dreadful demographics. And there are as many negative analysis of China as there are analysts, it seems. Brazil has also had its problems, which may or may not be alleviated by the coming of the World Cup of soccer next year and the Summer Olympics in 2016. To drill down into the country's prospects and look at some individual stock picks and ETFs, I've got Paul DeSisto on the line from New York. He's director and senior portfolio manager at M&R Capital, which has about $500 million in assets under administration. Welcome back to Emerging and Frontier Market Investing, Paul.
Thank you for inviting me, Gavin.
A pleasure. Just before we get into the analysis of Brazil, we're asking our guests this week whether or not the budget impasse in Washington, D.C. is having any effect on the emerging and frontier markets. Very little impact on Brazil so far?
There's been some impact, and part of the reason for that is notwithstanding the fear that the U.S. government may default, in fact, a lot of investors are buying treasuries because of the uncertainty of that and the feeling that treasuries will be paid. So that, because money is going into treasury, that is actually causing some downward pressure on emerging market currencies. It doesn't mean there won't be other factors that will offset that, but it actually has been somewhat of an effect, a negative effect for emerging market currencies.
Okay. Interesting sort of short-term effect, although obviously longer-term you might actually see those countries which aren't directly affected by it benefiting at some stage. Would you agree that the acronym BRIC is now past its sell-by date because the individual countries have gone in different directions?
Indeed, I do, Gavin. While a lot of these countries, or all of them, really want to increase the middle class and have more consumption-oriented economy, we know in this country it's 70% of the GDP is consumer-oriented. In these other countries, it's considerably less, and if they want to get up to Western standards of living, they're going to have to increase the amount of GDP that's attributable to consumer spending. That being said, you said it very well at the beginning of this portion, that these countries are different. They develop differently. They have different political systems. They have different economic systems. They have different cultures. China imports commodities and exports finished goods. When they lower their import of commodities, that hurts Brazil because they export commodities and they import a higher percentage of finished goods than it exports. Russia exports basically energy. It's a one-trick pony, frankly. It's a commodity and imports most finished goods. India has a different type of export, not so much people, but they export services when you can have your call center sent over there. So they're different. The countries are different in very many different ways, and I think that should be always considered when looking at them as an investment destination.
Indeed. Well, let's focus specifically on Brazil, which has had some economic problems. Growth slowed to 1% last year, but now there seem to be some small improvements. However, the markets obviously have been reflecting the bad news. Can you give us a rundown of what's been happening?
Well, the stock market basically was up tenfold from January 2003 until about 6 months ago. It has not been a good year. It has not been a good year for Brazil, but for other emerging markets as well. But Brazil in particular is down 13.5% in local currency. The ETF, EWZ, by which most U.S. investors invest in Brazil, is down 15.5% year to date. Now, there is some economic data showing there is improvement in the economy. Second quarter GDP growth was 100% higher than the first quarter, 3.3% year over year, so that's impressive. Unemployment rate has fallen to 5.3% in August from July's 5.6. Inflation in August slowed to 6.09, down from July's 6.25, as the central bank raised the benchmark Selic rate to 9% to control inflation. And the investment grade rating of the company continues to be stable, rated lower investment grade, Baa2, BBB, and BBB- across the three services that rate Brazil. So things are getting better, and whether it's going to be reflected in the stock market anytime soon is dependent on a lot of other things.
But one of the reasons, obviously, for the poor economic performance has been some specific economic problems, some outside influence, such as, obviously, the slowdown for China. You mentioned reducing demand for Brazilian exports, especially iron ore. But there have been some issues specific to Brazil as well. Could we touch on those briefly?
Brazil has instituted some more protectionist laws to defend and to promote its own economy. Taxes have been raised on foreign capital inflows, and there's been increasing private sector regulation and new import tariffs. It's been in the news a lot. The second largest oil company there, OGX, may have to declare Chapter 11 bankruptcy or their equivalent of Chapter 11 bankruptcy. So there's an issue there with that. There are also issues in the cities themselves. There was a very good story in The Economist 2 weeks ago about riots in a lot of the larger cities, particularly the poorer areas of these larger cities, which don't feel that they're getting the benefit of the growth. They have not got the public services such as water and sewer and schools that an increasing and improving economy should cause them, should give them. They're trying to clean up, and I mean the federal and the state governments, clean up some of the cities for these events that you talked about, the 2014 soccer, the 2016 Olympics. And the police have gone in and try to clean out some of the bad elements in some of these neighborhoods. But there's been a complaint of brutality by the police, some innocent people being hurt or even killed. So there are some issues peculiar to Brazil that have to be looked at unemotionally before one decides that they're going to make a big commitment to them.
You know, you mentioned some of the unhappiness was caused by the failure to deliver basic services like water and sewerage. Yet at the same time, the government isn't permitting the companies to actually raise rates, which they need to do to be able to pay, to build out the infrastructure, I believe. You have a particular example in Sao Paulo?
The Sao Paulo state is the determining or the regulating actor for the water and sewer company for Sao Paulo State and Sao Paulo City. Sao Paulo is the largest state in the entire country. And every few months they have to go and try to get some sort of rate regulation or rate relief. And the last time they went through, which was about 4 months ago, they didn't get the money they were asking for. They say they need these additional funds, these higher rates, so that they can complete the infrastructure improvements and they were denied. Now, they'll go back and forth to the governmental agencies. We don't know exactly what's going to happen. But to give you an idea, here's a company that had two stock splits earlier this year. The beginning of the year, they were trading at $14 a share. In spring, they reached late winter, they reached a high of 16.5. By October, they were down to $9, and they actually went below $8 before this small recovery to $9.79 a share. So the stock's lost 40% of its high due to denial by state authorities for the requested rates. That's been a problem.
Okay, so those are some of the problems. But if you were looking to invest in Brazil, Paul, which would be, first of all, the ETFs and funds you look at, and then maybe some individual stock picks, and let you take this all the way through till the commercial break?
Sure. Well, there are 10 ETFs, and they've all taken hits this year so far. Not a single one has been in the positive territory. The big boy is the iShares EWZ. It's down 10.7%. You have to look at these with a critical eye. 24 securities, but 28% weight in just financials, 17% in materials. It is an export-oriented economy, and 15% in staples and energy. So three-quarters of the fund in these sectors is really no healthcare, industrial, or other sectors represented in any meaningful way. The largest holding, which is the biggest bank in the country, is down 16%. That's Itaú, you know, Banco. And then at 7.5% of the portfolio, and the national oil company, Petrobras, which is being forced by the government to sell gasoline below cost. So there's that issue again of government interference. It's also 7.5%. So you have, and it's down 21% this year. So you have two companies making up a quarter of the portfolio. The Wisdom Tree is a small cap symbol BRF. It's much more diversified across sectors, but it hasn't helped. It's down 20% this year. There's an iShares small cap, EWZS, down 18%. The Infrastructure Fund, which you think would have a lot of activity possibly because they're trying to build the infrastructure, down 12%. And then First Trust Brazil is down 1.77%. That's the best of the bunch. So even the best of them is down a negative for the year, though 1.77% negative is nothing really to be too concerned with. The open-ended fund, there's only one. It's a Dreyfus. It's down 9.5%. Morningstar gives it 2 stars. It's nothing to write home about. So virtually all general Latin American funds, not just Brazil, have had negative returns for 2013. Of the 20 funds, the best was Euro Pacific Capital, which was down about 2%. Now, I would say going forward, the Ned Davis reversion to the mean charting system, and he's a service out of Florida, he says Brazil's EWZ iShares is neither oversold or overbought using their reversion to the mean charting system, which is peculiar to them. So I think people have to understand that there may be a time to get in there. It may not be now. Keep an eye on it if you want to get in that way. However, I think that because of the liquidity of some of these Brazil companies and because of the number of them listed on U.S. exchanges, one can actually put their own portfolio together.
And I would, which are some of the ones you like? Yep.
Well, five companies that I think are going to do well going long-term in the future and seem to be doing well as of recently, Brazil Foods, which is a food distributor. It's rated by several sell-side firms on the street. I can name them if you want me to. There's also the airplane manufacturer, Empresa Brasilia de Aeronautica, Embraer, we call it here. Symbol is ERJ. It's also listed on the stock exchange. And it's they make large business aircraft, and they're doing quite well. So there's a company that's in industrial. There's a TIM Participesos, which is cellular telephone service, which is also rated by several leading firms. And while there may be a slowdown in cellular service subscriptions, that eventually will recover. It's becoming sort of a must-have thing in many, many countries. Internet and television service provider Net Services to Comunicao is NETC. So there's another industry you're getting into, internet and television service provider. I don't think the internet is going to slow down anytime soon. And then the one I mentioned earlier, Saneamento SBS, which is the water and sewer company. We believe here at M&R, and we do own this in our portfolios, that the higher rates asked from the government by the company will be granted, as the higher income is going to be needed to expand the water and sewer infrastructure into the poorer areas of cities and towns and states. As you know, much of the interior is not developed. There's going to be a lot more work to do there to develop that interior. Infrastructure is going to come back, so we feel confident about that. If anybody is curious, if your listeners are curious, there's a website, buyupside.com, and they can go online and they can see a bunch of companies that are traded on the New York Stock Exchange, meaning it is a sponsored ADR. There is liquidity, hundreds of thousands of shares trade a day, and many of them actually pay dividends. And if one is uncertain, a dividend-paying stock may be a better way to go.
Absolutely, Paul. Well, that's a very thorough and comprehensive review of what's been going on in Brazil. Some excellent thoughts on ways to play it. Thanks very much indeed. Speak to you again soon.
My pleasure, Gavin. Thank you.
Thanks. And we will actually go straight to our next guest, because we're having the sometimes exciting telecommunication experience of speaking to people in Africa. Our next guest is Baldwin Burgess on the line from Accra. He's Managing Director of Silk Invest Funds, which specialize in frontier funds. And many Africa analysts actually consider Ghana one of the most attractive nations in Africa. In fact, wealthier on a GDP per capita basis than Nigeria. So I'm hoping when I say welcome back to the program, Baldwin, you're going to be on the other end of the line.
Hi, Gavin. In the end, we did make it. It was quite an adventure, but here I am. Thanks for having me again.
Delighted. Notwithstanding Nigeria and its oil revenues, we've heard several times on the program that Ghana is one of, if not the wealthiest country in sub-Saharan Africa, and it's attracting more outside investment to the country. Is that an accurate view, and are we seeing larger inflows coming in?
Yeah, in many ways it is. You know, investors are cutting a lot of slack for Ghana. You know, it's in the spotlight. It's seen as one of the most democratic nations in Africa. It's quite fair. It's faring quite well, but I would caution to say that these things often get overhyped, right? The yep. GDP per capita is higher than Nigeria. That's true, and it's actually it has acclaimed technically the middle income status. But you know, 1/3 of this population is still under the poverty line, and most of the jobs are still in the informal sector. So in many ways, this is still an African nation, right? I'm not saying that there's something wrong with it. It has a lot going for it, because it has. We like to see it as a lot of collateral as a country, right? It has a lot of resources. It has gold. It has cocoa. It has timber, bauxite, and since very recently, it also found crude oil. And a lot of the growth that we're witnessing is because you know, right now they're sort of in a race to get their infrastructure right to exploit that, and that's actually almost half of the country's output at the moment, right? And so it's also a fairly easy place to do business, and so that's why I guess a lot of foreign investors would like to sort of like make their first foray into sub-Saharan Africa through Ghana, right? But absolutely, you know, the reality also is, if you're familiar with Nigeria, you know, the Ghanaians are really not as voracious for business as the Nigerians are, you know, so they're a little bit more relaxed about life and things, but you know, I guess that's a good balance.
It's a good balance to have, and it does seem that the collateral, as you mentioned, the excellent resource exposure and the excellent, as it were, political infrastructure, has been reflected in the stock market performance. We're up what, almost 70% over the last year in U.S. dollar terms.
It's a high number. The Ghana Stock Exchange did very well this year so far. Let me say, I think it's building on a 24%+ increase of last year. Yep. And so, yeah, that stock market is doing very well. The thing with the equity market that it only captures a tiny proportion of its economy, right? So even if you exclude like the dual listings, the market capitalization is around $5 billion only. And so, you know, the companies that are listed are posting amazing returns, and especially in the banking sector, that's what draws a lot of attention. Like, for example, you've got banks like Eco Bank, you know, their earnings have grown more than 80% last year. Ghana Commercial Bank is near 60% earnings growth in 2012. You know, consumer brands are looking very pricey and are seeing a lot of attention as well, and especially also from PE firms. But yeah, I think what we have is a little bit of a we have a headline number, but we got to take into account that it's only a small portion of the economy that's represented that way.
Are there any, you mentioned the banks doing particularly well, are there any companies that or sectors that you think look particularly attractive, playing on increasing consumer incomes, mobile telecommunications, that sort of thing, or is it a more general strength across the board?
Yeah, there's strength across, I mean, back to the listing space, the listed spaces, you know, demand really exceeds supply. So, you know, what you get the companies that are listed are, you know, that's why they're being pushed up so much. But I think, you know, generally, sectors that we really like, the consumer space is something that makes a lot of sense because this economy is going into middle-class mode little by little. But then again, it's whatever is listed is quite pricey. Banking is interesting as well. It's the backbone of an economy, and it's this country is still very underbanked. So, there's not much competition, and so consumers or people who bank their money aren't really that. They don't really have much choice than to pay sort of rich fees in the banking sector here, you know. But I think the what we're looking at most of the time is really businesses that are scalable enough and capable of essentially winning in an economy. Which still is a low to medium economy and it can build the scale to capture that. So the private equity space is definitely the space where most of it's going to happen because what we see on the horizon in terms of new listings, that looks very thin. So for the time being,
okay.
I think we're going to be looking at more like, investors are going to have to go into this market through private equity more than anything.
All right, Baldwin. Well, thank you very much indeed. I very much appreciate your battling through the telecommunication difficulties to give us that update on what's happening in Ghana. And we'll be back in touch again soon, I'm sure.
Well, we eventually got connected, and that's the whole thing, right? These countries are connecting to the world, and if you really want it, you can manage it. So thanks again for having me.
A pleasure. Our thanks to Baldwin Burgess of Silicon Vest Funds on the line from Accra in Ghana. Our next guest has a long and distinguished career which roughly parallels the history of emerging markets funds. We'll check into which countries in the frontier markets have felt much impact from the crisis in Washington. We have Rich Hula on the line from Boston. He now heads the Argyle Companies, but earlier as a senior portfolio manager at Battery March Financial Management from 1984 to 1990, he established several emerging market funds for institutional investors, including Brazil and another one on Latin America. So welcome back to the program, Rich. And the last time we were speaking, we were talking about the way that markets could rebound from what looked to be pretty unprepossessing fundamentals and be interesting investments. We have the looming default crisis in Washington. Our other guests have been saying there hasn't really been a great deal of impact as far as frontier markets are concerned. Is that what you're seeing as far as the markets we're going to be talking about are concerned?
Yes, Gavin, it's great to be back, and it's exactly what seems to be happening. The only frontier markets that are showing vulnerability would have local issues. Egypt would be a good example. But Kenya is a very good example of a rebounding market that's been very strong now for quite a long time. Having done a little bit of research to see the long-term returns in the frontiers, you immediately see why they're so attractive to investors that can cope with the volatility. But the Kenyan market with the double issue of what's happening in the domestic U.S. situation and their local the terrorist attack there has rallied strongly for the last 2 weeks or so. And so that's within a very strong uptrend. And I also took a little look at what might be happening to some of the Middle Eastern markets. And the Saudi index had a pretty good decline from August into the first week in September. My guess is if I overlay the price of oil, there was a decline in the price of oil there. here or there, and that's been more the impact factor. But it's rebounded. A kind of in-between market in terms of global issues, truly a crossfire point would be Turkey. And the Turkish market has been in a more vulnerable position, but of course it seems to get pulled into the Syrian conflict, at least from a sort of macro perspective. But that's also in the context of a very long-term bull market that's been extremely strong.
That's very interesting,
here,
Richard.
They're not there.
I was going to say, but you said both Kenya and Turkey, both of which have had very specific events affecting them, whether it was a terrorist attack on the shopping mall or the fallout from the Syrian conflict, have actually been in longer-term bull markets and, in fact, rebounding quite strongly. So it would suggest that if the underlying fundamentals are there, they're resilient enough to shrug these off?
Yes, I think that if you think of G7 markets, they could have a 40% variance in a statistical sense against the U.S., and I think that the three markets that we're discussing may have 10%. If that much. They have much more local factors.
Yep. And, for Saudi, which you mentioned, first of all, overlaying it against the price of oil is obviously a very important point, because although Saudi Aramco isn't actually quoted, the knock-on effects from the oil revenues are very large. But at the same time, it's the moment it's not open to direct foreign investment as well.
Is that, you would think, an insulating
factor as well?
Yes, absolutely. I'm a very strong believer that the local pricing agents within frontier markets are much more powerful than anything that can come in from the outside. And therefore tracking their behavior in local currency is really the critical factor. Some of the Emirates and Saudi markets have a direct impact from dollar or euro based investors. There would be some change, but locals are very sophisticated, and they're not going to allow that to get out of hand.
So to finish up, Rich, you mentioned obviously that these markets have been pretty resilient, that the local pricing agents, local factors are a lot more important than foreign investment. Is there an issue, though, which is one thing that always tends to get raised with frontier markets in particular, about liquidity? Because if you do see some bad news, then it does tend to dry up a little.
Yes, and I'm glad you brought that point up, because as a longtime observer, you've lived through the illiquidity phases that most of
too
us
right.
pretend don't happen because we don't like to think about them. I would say that the that liquidity in down phases is extremely important, and in fact, in terms of your long-term performance, it's when you really shouldn't be involved in the downside. You'd be able to tolerate those 20% declines, because they lead to exceptionally good opportunities.
So even the bad news is good news, essentially.
Yes, and by the way, one of the Bloomberg has been running regular commercials for a Blue Nile fund, and I have know nothing about the Blue Nile folks, and I have not read their prospectus, but I can get a picture of what's happening within their fund, and it basically is tracking the U.S. small cap index, and that would make sense, because U.S. investors would think similarly about liquidity about both places. That doesn't mean that it has anything to do with the U.S. small caps, but that correlation is something to be explored a bit, and that to me is a good proxy. If volume dries up in the selling inside the Blue Nile fund as well as in the parallel markets, that's exactly the pattern that you expect to see in frontier markets. It's panicky selling, very sharp, very large percentage, low liquidity. It gets read by standard U.S. investing theory as bad and very negative, and in fact, it's not at all. Obviously, if you get caught in the wrong market at the wrong time and you get in a secular problem, that's a little bit different, but hopefully have done enough background to know when to stay away.
Excellent. Thanks very much for those wise words, Rich. And as you say, the benefit of experience, you can live with the liquidity drying up as long as you're confident in your longer-term thesis. I'm sure we'll be back to talk with you again about other frontier markets and the effect that the outside events are having.
Yeah. Very good, Evan, and it's always great to be here.
Thanks so much. Our thanks to Rich Hula at the Argyle Companies on the line from Boston for that element of good news about the situation in Washington. When I come back from the break, I'll be checking into the large number of initial public offerings in Dubai. Some of them may eventually end up in your global frontier market fund. Please stay with me for that.
The boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
This program comes to you from the EFMI Media Company. EFMI Media is one of the most comprehensive sources of information and analysis on emerging and frontier markets. EFMI Media has become a leader in knowledge, expertise, and analysis of emerging and frontier markets, both in opportunities to investigate and pitfalls to avoid. For further information about EFMI Media, go to www.emergingfrontier.ca or call 416-944-1750. EFMI Media produces this program, researched and wrote Investing in Frontier Markets, Opportunity, Risk, and Role in an Investment Portfolio, which is set for release later this year, and is currently working on a second book, also on frontier markets. EFMI also publishes a newsletter called EFMI Information and provides knowledgeable speakers on these and other topics. For further information about EFMI Media, go to www.emergingfrontier.ca, write to info@emergingfrontier.ca, or call 416-944-1750.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned into Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with Gavin Graham. To connect with our program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's toll-free in North America, 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to the final segment of Emerging and Frontier Market Investing. I'm Gavin Graham. As I mentioned, there's a number of IPOs that have been taking place in Dubai. And to actually have a look at what's been going on, I have Thomson Reuters financial correspondent Nadia Salim on the line from Dubai. Welcome to the program, Nadia.
Hi, Gavin.
So I've been asking all the guests this week on the show the question about whether the U.S. budget impasse in Washington, D.C. has been having any effect on their markets. Would it be fair to say that really the Gulf markets and Dubai in particular have not really been affected by what's going on in the U.S.?
There was some pressure last week due to the shutdown, but there were other factors at play here as well. Some of it was simply people taking some cash off for a long market holiday here next week.
So some limited selling, but in essence, nothing major. So let's turn to the various IPOs. Does the fact that Dubai is regarded as a safe haven within the Middle Eastern markets play a crucial role into this, or is it just helpful?
I think it's helped in largely in terms of the trading that's come back on the market after a few dry years. A part of it is definitely from its safe haven status. The other part would be local improvement in fundamentals.
And obviously that's been the recovery from the financial crisis. So the stock market is up a lot year to date. Do you have the number there?
It's around 70% or so, and I think it's only second to Venezuela in the world.
But that still leaves it a long way below its 2008 peak, correct?
That's right. That's right. There was a major crash on the market in 2008, and very dull sort of flatlining for consecutive years until early last year that the market saw a pickup.
And so, with the pickup, we've seen people starting to bring companies to market because they feel it's a good time to sell shares. They'll get a good price for them. Could you give us some of the companies that have been doing IPOs in Dubai at the moment?
Sure. We're still at an early stage in terms of IPOs. Mostly companies have expressed plans, not actually gone through with the IPO, except Bank of London and Middle East, which just did their IPO this week. And the other two that we're looking at is just Falafel. It's a regional restaurant chain. And the other one is it's a real estate fund. It's called Emirates Real Estate Fund, basically.
Well, we touch on just Falafel in a second. But as you said, the Bank of London and Middle East has actually gone ahead with IPO. How much did it raise, and did the IPO go off successfully?
But honestly, the first day of trading, there wasn't much trading on the stock. They chose to list on the Nasdaq Dubai as opposed to the sort of more active market, which is the Dubai financial market. So it was very limited trading on the first day, and there was a very small float off the listing, of the company listed.
Right. How much is the company worth after the listing in terms of its market capitalization?
I don't have the figure on me right now, but I think the share price offer was at around 2, let me just have a look here, it's around $2.2 and like 100,000 shares offered. So we can plot the market cap from that, get an idea.
Indeed, as you say, a pretty small issue. So are there some larger issues coming? And if so, will they be coming in Dubai or will they look to London, which a number of other frontier markets have done in terms of getting a higher profile and more liquidity?
You're right about the barracks. And it doesn't seem like there will be anything major happening in the Dubai market, where we're still hoping for something big to come out from here, perhaps one of the government-related entities. But the ones that have expressed interest are relatively small.
And there are also some other companies within the United Arab Emirates looking to list, and they are looking at London. Is that correct?
Yes, that would be DEMAC. It's a property firm, private property company, and there's some talks in the market that they'd be looking for like $1 billion, but it's not really confirmed just yet. So that would be a major one, and if they do go to London Exchange as they've said, then we'll be losing the first big one out of here in a while.
And then there was also a hospital group as well that's looking at a flotation.
If you're referring to NMC, it's a national medical company, they've already done their listing at the London Stock Exchange, that did quite well.
Oh, that's right, I'm sorry. Yep. And then there's Al Noor Hospitals as well, which listed, was it June this year?
Yes, you're right. The two healthcare companies that went to the London Exchange.
So would it be fair to say that while... obviously, the Gulf financial markets would be very keen to see some more IPOs. At the moment, the bigger ones seem to be going to London, and the ones that are listing are relatively small. And what's needed would be one of the state control groups deciding to actually do a major listing in Dubai or in Abu Dhabi.
Yes, that's pretty much it. And I think some of the hesitation is on the part for a part of requirements, listing requirements on the Dubai financial market as well as the Abu Dhabi exchange, because we've got pretty different requirements on the Nasdaq Dubai, which is sort of functions under a free zone sort of regulator. And it is international standards, it is easier, but somehow these companies that do look to list on Nasdaq Dubai, they have a very small free float, small listings. And we would need something major in terms of an IPO on the Dubai financial market to show that the market really has brought back the confidence from companies to look at this market again as a source of fundraising.
So if you were to see a listing by Emirates Airline or the Dubai Electricity Authority, then that would be a big sign of confidence in Dubai financial market, and also be a sign that the authorities are willing to actually encourage it by listing some of their crown jewels.
That's right. Emirates, and I think the other one you mentioned, they've looked at the fixed income market till now. Trade funds, I guess they have their own concerns about partly retaining ownership of the companies, as well as maybe they don't think these markets are quite ready yet for these companies to list here. But they would definitely change things. They would bring diversity to the market, first of all, which is mainly made up of banks and real estate firms.
Excellent. Well, thanks very much indeed, Nadia, for that insight into the IPO market and what maybe needs to happen before it becomes a sign of confidence. Hope to have you back
soon.
Thanks, Kevin. Cheers.
Thank you.
Kevin.
It's been a pleasure.
Thanks to Nadia Salim of Thomson Reuters in Dubai for that look of the IPOs that are happening in the Gulf, or perhaps more accurately, the ones that are not happening yet. That wraps up today's edition of Emerging from Frontier Markets Investing. Please join me again next week. We'll have another global roster of contributors from various locations around the world looking at emerging and frontier markets, which will include John Derrick at US Global Investors in San Antonio, Texas, looking at the former communist bloc countries in Eastern Europe. Ahmed Hafez, North American advisor for the National Bank of Kuwait, will be giving us analysis of the International Monetary Fund conference in Washington, while familiar guest on the program, Peter Merrick, the demographics researcher, will be talking about Indonesia, and another guest from the Middle East, Mark Townsend in Dubai, will be talking about the flows of money from various financial centers such as Singapore into the Gulf area. Mark was an important contributor to our book, which is Investing in Frontier Markets, Opportunity, Risk, and Role in an Investment Portfolio, which my co-author and producer of this program, Al Emmett, and I published with John Wiley and Sons this last month. And we have a next book, which is Frontier Markets for Dummies, scheduled for release in spring 2014. We're the publishers of the AFMI newsletter. For more information, please write to info@emergingfrontier.ca. Again, that's info@emergingfrontier.ca. Thanks very much.
Thanks for listening today to Emerging and Frontier Markets Investing with host Gavin Graham. Be sure to join us again next Wednesday at 6 a.m. Pacific Time, 9 a.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel for another edition. Have a profitable week.